From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, we'll check in with Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers on yesterday's third and what may be the final debate between the two chief gubernatorial candidates. Then it's on to yesterday's Don't Ask, Don't Tell federal court ruling. And in the bottom half of the hour, we meet Dante Cini, a co-author of Our Patchwork Nation. Patchwork Nation is a reporting project designed to explore the U.S. demographically by dividing the nation's 3,141 counties into 12 community types based on income level, racial composition, employment, and religion. Forum is up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We're going to look in this first half hour of Forum this morning at the historic ruling that came down yesterday in a United States District Court in Riverside, California, ending the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy ban on openly gay troops. But first, we want to get reaction to last night's third and perhaps final gubernatorial debate, which was held at Dominican University in San Rafael between Democrat Jerry Brown and Republican Meg Whitman. KQED's Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers was there, and he joins us for this, well, I'm calling it a brief briefing. John, good to have you aboard.
Thanks, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, you said that this featured personal attacks, policy disagreements, in the end, two very different visions of what the state needs. But the race is so close now, and the polls and that's why yesterday was so intense. What kind of difference is it going to make, do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because, I mean, there are a few things here. First of all, we don't really know yet how many people tuned into this. I mean, you know, one of the we had started out as a joke in the press room, and it turned out not to be much of a joke, is that people would be watching the rescue of the Chilean miners instead of a debate. And I'm not sure that's too far off of the truth. And so, you know, I don't know how many folks stick around for the whole thing. I would look at it this way, though. There are three debates here if you kind of look at the totality of them. I think if you look at it that way, Jerry Brown probably did better in the debate part of this campaign than Whitman. I think Whitman had a better night last night than she's had in the others, probably slightly better than Brown. But I don't know if that moves the needle or not. I mean, again, it depends on whether the voters want issues or whether they're trying to examine character and how people, you know, answer questions on their feet. And, you know, if you're looking for issues, there wasn't a whole lot of new stuff in any of the debates, last night included.
Last night seemed to be almost utterly lacking in specificity in many ways.
There were a few nuggets out of it. I mean, I will be fair to them on that. There were some things about government reform that we haven't really heard a lot about yet. Meg Whitman says she wants a 2-year budget process. Brown says, you know, let's don't have any programs unless we've identified funding for them. Those are somewhat new. I think there were some differences on pensions and how you deal with the reform of public employee pensions. But there was a lot of familiar stuff here, and also some of the latest fracas of the race from the last week about this audio tape of Brown and his campaign staff disparaging Ms. Whitman. That had to come up too. And, you know, again, there was a lot of character discussion last night. And if that's what the voters want, that's what they got.
Well, disparaging, he used the W word to describe.
Or someone on his staff did.
Right. And that came back from Tom Brokaw as being comparable to the N word where race is concerned.
Yeah. And you know, Michael, on that one, I got to say, I think Jerry Brown missed a vital opportunity to get rid of that story. I mean, you know, I think that Brown would have been much better served by just looking at Ms. Whitman and saying, you know, Ms. Whitman, I apologize. You know, that kind of language isn't appropriate. And, you know, let's stick to the issues.
Well, he did say that, didn't he?
Well, he only after Brokaw prompted him. What he started off with was, well, I don't know if it's a fair comparison to the N-word. You couldn't really tell what was on the tape. It was weeks ago. I'm not sure if it's legal to have recorded it. It was a parsing of the issue that made him sound like he was not really willing to say, I'm sorry, it was the wrong thing to do. And I think that did not serve him well. I think Whitman got the better end of that exchange.
Is that part of the reason why you think that Whitman did better in yesterday's debate?
I think she was less nervous. I think she was more focused. I think she had some she had some better responses to some of Brown's issues. I think while I still think that Brown probably is where the polls are with the voters, for instance, about climate change in California and suspension of that law, I think Whitman explained her position much better, saying what's wrong with taking a break and trying to make sure that this is the right thing to do for just 1 year. That was a much better description of her position than I think she's had in previous debates. And I think finally in the third debate, she got comfortable with these formats. But again, it's late in the game. We're 20 days from Election Day, and you know, where the voters really tuned in.
No more debates, but we may see these two together again, at least from what I'm reading.
Yeah, we're expected to see them in Southern California in L.A. Maria Shriver has an annual women's conference down there. And apparently at this conference, I think it's on the 26th, so I guess it's 2 weeks from yesterday, Governor Schwarzenegger is going to be on stage with Brown and Whitman. I don't know if this is some kind of kumbaya moment or what it's going to be, but that'll be the last time apparently we see them. And again, at this point, they're just out campaigning hard. They're on the campaign trail, Whitman today, Brown with Bill Clinton and possibly President Obama in about a week in Southern California. And it's a race to the finish. I mean, all the polls show that it's close. The campaigns say they're opening leads, but those are private polls. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the voters finally decide when they come off the fence.
A lot more TV commercials to come between now and November 2nd.
Indeed.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
John Myers, our Sacramento Bureau Chief, reporting on the debate. And by the way, he mentioned the Chilean miners, which, of course, is an extraordinary and dramatic story. And for those of you who are tracking it, 16 Chilean miners have been rescued so far, and the process continues. I can't imagine that much excitement, except maybe, well, even more excitement. I think it would eclipse Chile winning World Soccer Cup. We're going to talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell for the rest of this half hour. Federal U.S. District Judge Virginia Phillips yesterday ordered the U.S. military through an injunction to stop enforcing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and that ends the ban on openly gay troops. Or does it? Well, the military originally was sued by the Log Cabin Republicans, a gay rights group, and the policy had been declared unconstitutional in a September 9th ruling by the same judge. You should note that over 12,500 have been expelled from the military since the policy first went into effect. And joining us to sort all this out and discuss yesterday's decision is Aaron Belkin. He's here with us in studio. He's director of the Palm Center at UC Santa Barbara, also associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University. And welcome, Aaron Belkin.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you aboard. Also good to have John Arquilla, who is with us from the Naval Postgraduate School, where he's professor of defense analysis and special ops and directs the Information Operations Center there. And John Arquilla, welcome to you.
Hi, Michael.
Hi to you. And let me begin, Aaron Belkin, with you. Let's try to sort this out as best we can in terms of what this means. It may mean a whole lot, or, you know, there are appeals that are coming down the line, possibly from all kinds of sources, and it may not mean anything conclusive.
Well, we can talk about what it means politically and operationally, but I would say that the biggest implication is symbolic. For the first time in 65 years yesterday, the military is no longer allowed to fire gay and lesbian troops just for being gay. So yesterday, for the first time since World War II, we have a situation where gays and lesbians are allowed to serve openly. Now, that could change tomorrow if the administration decides to appeal the ruling and receives a stay from the court. But for now, we have no gay ban for the first time in generations.
Well, and the injunction applies to U.S. Armed Forces worldwide, but the Justice Department has a couple months to appeal. The president can appeal. It's under investigation by the Defense Department. There's lots of things here that could at least stave off what might be not only an extraordinary historical ruling, as you're suggesting, but one that's going to have major impact.
Well, it's complicated on many levels because, as you said, if the administration and the Justice Department decide to appeal the ruling and they receive a stay, this case could take 5 more years to work its way through the appellate courts, through the Supreme Court. At the same time, if the administration decides not to appeal, then Don't Ask, Don't Tell is dead. Parallel to that, there's a political process going on. The Senate could take action this year or in the future to get rid of the policy. So we don't know.
The Senate had filibustered it, so it didn't go through, though it did go through the House, we should mention, just for the record. Yeah,
that's right. So if the Senate is going to take action, it would have to be during the lame duck session. We don't know if it's going to be the Congress or the president through an executive order or the courts that finally get rid of this policy.
Of course, the president said he was wanting to get rid of it quite some time ago. As early as 1993, he went public with that.
The president has been a very strong opponent of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and a proponent of inclusiveness. As yet, however, it's not clear that he's willing to issue an executive order or to decline to appeal this case. So far, what he's said is he wants to work through Congress.
John Arquilla, what about people who want to sign up for the service now? I mean, can they just go in and say, I'm gay and I'm ready to sign up and put my name on the dotted line?
Well, as Aaron says, this legal matter is going to wend its way through the courts, especially if there's an appeal, possibly for years. Legislation can be tied up for long periods of time. Gay service members have volunteered for decades since we've had the all-volunteer force. They generally have not advertised this. They haven't been able to, and I think a good policy would be not to do so. It's one thing to call an end to the business of drumming these folks out of the service. It's quite another to suggest that the behavior should be far more open. And I think that's where maybe we have a social compromise that can emerge here, where there is the tacit agreement to stop the pursuits and the expulsion of gay service members, while at the same time having a little bit of care in the social ethos of our military not to be too open about this. I think in the Pentagon there's a great deal of concern about the effects on military cohesion, particularly in some of our elite units or combat units. And I think we have to proceed with a little bit of care. You know, this is the thorniest problem the military faces. It's the last of the great civil rights issues, if you will, the racial integration that President Truman began 60-some years ago, equality for women, which in theory came 30 years ago, and now for gays. And what we see in each of those is that it takes decades to work those problems out. So I think this is a very, very positive development, but I think we do need to proceed with a fair amount of caution.
And you would not necessarily advise service people to come out then?
I personally wouldn't. Especially in some of the units out there, it would cause heedless trouble. Look, a simple demographic is when you think about American society, 1 in 7 Americans identify as an evangelical Christian. Within the military, that number is around half, and two-thirds of the chaplains identify as evangelical Christian. That's the social ethos. And I think there's a way to serve, and a lot of gay service members, some that I know, simply want to do their duty, serve their country. They love this kind of work. It's a profession of great dignity and importance to our society, and I think there's a way to do that without roiling the social waters too much, at least not now, because I think a generation from now, young service members are going to say, what was all that fuss about, just as they say that about race. But 30 years ago, race still was a problem. Now it's not. I think the same thing's going to happen with gay service members.
Well, Judge Phillips said that the court found no evidence of discrimination against some soldiers as being good for the military. In your book, though, General Aquila, don't you say that it shouldn't be eliminated for some sections of the military?
Yeah, I really think there are some units where we don't want to be open about inserting gay members, just as today women don't serve in some of the combat units out there. Now, in an era of irregular warfare, they get blown up by IEDs and such, but they're not trying to integrate women into some units. And I think a good step right now is to be cautious about where we insert into some of these counterterror task forces and such. But there are lots and lots of other places. A lot of gay service members do wonderful work in combat. Many of the interpreters, some of the finest language skills, and sadly, by the thousands, we've been driving them out of the service. That has to stop, but I don't think we go on sort of full auto, and I don't think in any of the July 4th parades we're going to have some open demonstration of gay service members for a while, and nor do I think we should just yet.
John Aquila, again, is Professor of Defense Analysis in Special Ops and Director of the Information Operations Center at the Naval Postgraduate School. You may have some reaction to yesterday's ruling. It still could take years with appeals and rulings and maybe even going all the way up to the Supreme Court, but this is a historic ruling, and it certainly has had reverberations already. If you have something you'd like to say about the ruling or if you have a question or comment, we welcome your phone call. Our lines are open and available to you, and now would be the time to call. This is a half-hour segment, so get your calls in. It's toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and that will work whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. If you'd like to have the opportunity of joining this conversation, please do so. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. We'll go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I just wanted to ask you, though, Aaron Belkin, given your background as a political scientist, you didn't think perhaps that the Republicans would make much of a campaign out of this, but aren't they going to say this is another example of an activist judge playing too prominent a role?
Well, we live in a system of civilian control of the military, and for more than two centuries, the law of the land has been that if a federal court finds a military policy to be unconstitutional, the military does not get a free pass when it comes to following the law. And so, I mean, what was activist was that 41 senators blocked a bill that 70% of the American public supports. So in no way is the military immune from judicial rulings.
70% polling has been certainly a factor, one has to admit, here. John Arquilla, can the military maybe come up with some new policy in the face of this ruling or in the wake of this strong support, the American people, of opposition?
Well, I think the compromise is before us right now. The military should simply agree to stop drumming gay service members out when they are found out or out themselves. That's a good first step. And then the second, I think, if the chairman would, who himself favors repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, would simply say, look, let's proceed with caution. This is a civil rights matter. These things take decades to work out. So let's stop driving these people out of the service, but let's also be cautious about where we make these insertions and how much openness there is. There are some units where gay service members are already well accepted, and interpreters, and indeed in some infantry units. But I know for a fact that in some of the more elite combat units, there would be great, great resistance. Again, as I said, the Christian ethos is very strong in this military, and for most of those members, it's the book of Leviticus that guides their behavior, not a decision by a judge in the Central District of California.
Aaron Belkin.
Look, Professor Arquilla is acting like this is a thorny problem. He even said this is one of the thorniest problems the military has to face, that it's going to take decades to work this out. All of the research shows, this is research by military think tanks, by military professors, lifting a gay ban is not difficult. It's something where you snap your fingers and the change happens. The fact is, gays and lesbians are serving openly now. Half of the troops in the military know a gay or lesbian peer in their unit, and that includes special forces units. I know openly gay SEALs. The last thing you want to do is to create gay units and straight units. I mean, imagine what happens. You have the straight nuclear submarine, the elite nuclear submarine, and the nuclear reactor breaks, and the straight repairman is sick. Do you not bring in the gay repairman who's available next door? I mean, it's ridiculous. The military is one organization. This is not like integrating women or race, which were difficult problems. Note what happened yesterday. The court ordered the military to lift the ban. Did unit cohesion suffer yesterday? I don't think so. This is not a difficult problem.
Now, let's hear what our listeners have to say, and Gregory, we'll begin with you. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, it's really sad that he's using, trumping the Christian card to say that there's going to be some implication why these people can't do their jobs. I mean, it's just ridiculous. These people come up with these reasons why we have to exclude somebody because they're different. And, you know, we thought the same thing about women, and look at them now. You know, we're so ridiculous. They're totally capable of doing a job, you know, and we keep using these excuses to exclude people, and it's just, you know, to say that someone's a Christian, they can't serve next to somebody, but they can, you know, open fire on people and do all kind of other things that are against things that are in the Bible. You know, come on, grow up.
Well, John Arquilla, getting some of these kind of responses by email too. One of the listeners simply wants to know, and maybe this is the key question: how is military cohesion threatened?
Well, in a frontline or a counter-terrorist unit, where you do have people who are, you know, they feel they have their own rights to privacy and such, and feel that being with gay members would break the tight bond that holds these people together in combat and has for years. And it is the reason the military wants to study this more carefully. Let me just say, I'm not suggesting that these gay service members can't do their job. To the contrary, I think they're wonderful in all the services where they are. There are many units where it's not an issue. There are some units where it is. And all I'm suggesting, and I'm, you know, entirely, you know, want to see the world that Aaron envisions come to be as quickly as possible. I don't think it happens tomorrow or because of that judge's decision. There is a social ethos we have to pay attention to. When President Truman said no more race discrimination in 1948, it was really 30 years Before that, the logjam began to break and true equal opportunity emerged. For women, 30 years ago, equality was declared, and it's only now beginning to get there, and they're kept out of a lot of combat units. So I'm not talking about creating a sacred band of, you know, a gay unit here and a straight unit there. I think mostly we can be very well integrated, but I think we have to pay attention to the fact that these social problems do require some time to work out. And in a period of extensive and possibly perpetual warfare, one of the things you don't want to do is make social change that is going to undermine your combat capabilities.
All right, I want to get another caller on here who I think may be more sympathetic to the view you're putting forward, John Aquila. Anthony is a Marine officer. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guests bring up some great points all along, and there's one thing I wanted to say was that we have sat around, me and my staff, and I work with some senior officers. We don't really talk about this issue because we know it's going to come down from above, and it's not really a cohesion issue to us as it is, I guess, so much an issue of, oh, God, if this actually happens, we're going to have to deal with it as leaders. And it's a responsibility that we have, but the biggest problem we look at is the Marine Corps is such, or in the military in general, is such a melting pot. It takes pieces from everywhere. You're going to have the coast, you're going to have the center of the country, the south, everything. You are going to have individuals within that, much like your guests have noted, that will have an objection to openly gay service members being within the unit, whether it be combat units or supply units or anything like that. And the challenge that we face as officers, and that I think is really going to be the problem, is how do you deal with having one of them in the unit, and I don't mean them in a bad way, but just having a member who's specifically identified or maybe comes out and is very open about what they are. That is going to be the cohesion problem that I think we're facing. And it's simply something that we'll work out after a generation. But for the here and now, it is going to be a challenge. And that is really what I think our leaders at the highest levels are going to have to deal with.
The challenge, I suspect, maybe can be phrased or framed, Aaron Belkin, of having to have homophobia emerge as a result.
No. No. It's not a challenge. In Britain and Canada, two-thirds of service members said they would not work with gays and lesbians if bans were lifted in those countries. Bans were lifted. Ministries did studies. They found that there were no problems of adjustment. Gays and lesbians are serving openly now. What the RAND Corporation and other military scholars have found is that this is a question of leadership, but it's not a difficult question of leadership. If leaders say that service members are expected to work together, they're professional. They all have differences. Some people don't like Southerners. Some people don't like Jews. Some people don't like whatever identity. But the military has good leaders, and they make the troops work together. If leaders send the simple signal that troops are expected to work together, you will have no problems. If, however, you treat this as a thorny, complicated problem, as Anthony and as John Aquila are suggesting, and you say that we need decades, we need to study this over time, that's when you open the Pandora's box for problems.
Seconds left here. Final word from you, John Aquila.
Oh, well, I can meet Aaron halfway. Stop drumming gay service members out right now, but realize that these things do take time to work themselves out.
All right, and I want to give one statistic here, since I know there are many listeners who are fiscal-minded. The Pentagon did a study. The policy has cost $363.8 million, just for the record. We're coming up on another segment, and in the segment ahead, we're going to meet Dante Cini, who has written a book called Our Patchwork Nation. He's part of a patchwork project, and you'll find out more about that in the half hour ahead. Let me thank Aaron Belkin from the Palm Center in San Francisco State and John Aquila from the Naval Postgraduate School and John Myers, who we checked in with on the gubernatorial debate. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.